Hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast. My name is Richard Moore and I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And a special guest in the absence of Daniel Freeb, who is frolicking in the French mountains with the young Frenchman from Française des Jeux, Ned Bolting.
You're really good at that. That was all unscripted and just straight off the top of your head, wasn't it?
That was good at the script in my head, Ned.
You're really good.
Where are we, Lionel? We're somewhere new today.
We are. We're outside the British Library in the Courtyard Cafe. Jolly night it is. Sun's shining. It feels like the Tour de France is just round the corner with this sun beating down. I got sunburnt yesterday out on my bike, but it's still 6 weeks away, isn't it?
So we are in the glaring sunshine here. I'm a little bit worried about your head, Lionel. Is it going to be okay?
I'm wearing headphones, which will give me a fetching stripe across the top of my head. Yeah.
The Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
We've been watching the Tour of California, the Giro, and the Women's Tour. We're a bit late coming to the Women's Tour, but we weren't actually at the Women's Tour. We were at the Giro. Ned was at the Women's Tour, so he's going to report back on that. But first of all, the Tour of California, which has seen the return to winning form of Sir Bradley Wiggins. He won the Tour of Britain last year, of course, and a lot of talk now of whether this is a sign that Wiggins really is back to his best or approaching his best, and whether, you know, he'll go to the Tour in the kind of form that he was in 2012. What do you think? Did you see much of the Tour of California, Lionel?
I did, yeah. I stayed up and watched a few. I'd say stayed up. It was over by 11:30. I can stay up that late if I want. I watched quite a few of the stages. I saw Cavendish's win on the opening day, and Wiggins winning the time trial. It wasn't the most riveting time trial, but then, you know, very few time trials are, really, are they? Sorry.
When was the last riveting time trial in any race anywhere in the world ever?
1989
Tour de France, the final day. It was there'd been a few incidents
25 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it wasn't a great watch, that, but it was an impressive performance. He put 44 seconds in only 12 miles, which, you know, by any stretch, that is an impressive ride. And then he was equally impressive on Mount Diablo and again at Mountain High, the two summit finishes in the race. But it was very difficult to judge those kind of wide Californian highway-style climbs. Television always flattens out the gradient a bit anyway. But the way that Wiggins rode, particularly at Mount Diablo, it looked like he was giving himself a bit of a ramp test rather than racing to win the race, oddly. And, I mean, people got quite excited about how impressive he looked, but if you look at the riders behind him, it wasn't like it was an A-list group of Grand Tour riders, was it?
Ned, did you see much of California?
Well, I saw the hilarious false win the other day on the penultimate lap, which I hope we can discuss in length, poor lad. But I agree with the point you've just alluded to, Richard, about the Tour of California belonging to the set of races throughout the cycling calendar, which are really hard to judge and to assess and put in their proper worth. You know, every rider comes to it with a slightly different agenda and with a different focus later on in the season that actually they're aiming towards. Unless your name is Chris Horner or Levi Leipheimer, you don't really target.
Or Bradley Wiggins in this case,
yeah.
Because he has been talking about this race all year.
But the question is, I mean, Taylor Finney is that's a proper, you know, that's something you can look at and go, that's a proper thing there, putting 44 seconds, did you say, Lionel, into him? Does that reflect badly on Finney? Well, on Wiggins, a bit of both. But who else was in the time trial who really, you know, you could, you know, that's where we judge Bradley Wiggins still, isn't it? Who else was he up against there, Lionel, really?
Rowan Dennis, really, I suppose, was, you know, and Jack Bobridge, who showed little bits and pieces through the week, but not really, didn't really...
I didn't realise that I'd missed this, and probably the rest of the world knew that Jack Bobridge was suffering with rheumatoid arthritis.
Yeah.
He was always a very promising young rider. I remember how aggressive he has been in races, as well as being an excellent time trialist, and somehow that story missed me, so he's battling back from arthritis and did show some decent form. But yeah, Rohan Dennis was the closest rival, and again, he's a very similar background to Wiggins, similar kind of build, Team Pursuit, member of the Team Pursuit team in London 2012 that won a silver medal behind Great Britain. You know, he's an up and coming road rider, very much in the mould of Wiggins, and it did, as you say, that the climbs lent themselves to that sort of time trialist ruler type effort, like a ramp sort of effort rather than a climber's climb. Tour of California was a star-studded race, but the stars were Peter Sagan, Mark Cavendish, Taylor Finney, Bradley Wiggins. They were sort of spread across the different specialities, I suppose. And so to win the race overall, you can't criticise somebody for winning a race. That's the thing. All you can do is beat the people who are there.
No, I don't think anyone's doing that. But what we're highlighting is the difficulty in assessing what that means.
Trying to look at it in context.
Exactly, because it's not the. You know, 2012 when he won Romandy and the Dauphiné, it's not that, is it? You know, the climbs are different, everything's different about the race, and I don't think it's in that order of preparation that we should view it slightly different. Is it worth a hat tip to Adam Yates again?
Certainly, more than that.
Yeah,
more than a hat tip. I don't know what that would entail. I mean, the other thing about Wiggins, though, I think is worth saying is that...
Was that the hat tip to Adam Yates?
Return to Adam Yates.
Well, that wasn't more than a hat tip, that was less than a hat tip.
No, I'm building up to the hat tip. Right. We're going to return to Adam Yates in a minute. The important thing to say about Wiggins is that for all that it might not have been up there with the Dauphiné or Romandy or Paris-Nice in 2012, you shouldn't underestimate the importance of winning to Wiggins and the confidence he will get from that. And I think it wasn't a terrifically strong team performance, although Joe Dombrowski showed very well on Mountain High. Wiggins had to do quite a lot on his own in the end, and he will get a lot from winning that race, and he will feel good about himself, and that's got to augur well for him going into the final sort of preparation races for the Tour. You know, he's put himself. It would be a controversial decision not to pick him for the Tour team.
You can't not pick him. You can't not pick him for all the for all the potential problems that brings with it. He's too good a rider to admit.
What about if Chris Froome says he doesn't want him in the team? What then?
Well, that's the only reason why you wouldn't select Bradley Wiggins. And is it in Chris Froome's nature to deselect Bradley Wiggins off his own bat, or would he think actually I could really do with Wiggins on those climbs?
I think there's a question as well about. You know, who else do you pick? Yeah. Sky have not exactly been setting the world on fire this
illness
year.
Illness has disrupted them, and Port is a bit of a mystery this season.
Absolutely.
Pete Kenyuk's had illness after, slight early season promise, and then not much since, so let's see how he goes. I'm assuming now Pete Kenyuk not riding the Giro will be back in the saddle for the Tour, you would imagine. But the other thing about Wiggins is that the placement of the time trial on the Tour kind of works in favour of selecting Wiggins, because if there had been a time trial, say, at the end of the first week or buried in that first week somewhere, that would have been a problem. That could have been a really big problem that would have given Sky a headache.
I hesitate to mention 1986 and...
Is there any literature available about that?
A week into that race, Bernardino said, let's let the first time trial decide who leads the team. That's what he did. And, you could imagine a scenario where if Wiggins is the guy ahead of Froome, although who's to say that he would actually, it would be pretty close between them, I think, in a time trial at the moment. Perhaps.
Would it, do you think?
I think it'd be close.
I think the thing is, Ned, the point you made there about everyone knowing that the only reason Wiggins wouldn't go to the Tour would be if Chris Froome had had some input. If that were to happen, that also piles a hell of a lot of pressure on Chris Froome's shoulders, because everyone would then know that.
Yeah.
And then Chris Froome is saying, well, I am the leader and there's, it's me alone.
Yeah.
And while that would obviously unite the rest of the team behind him, particularly if Port comes back and comes into form, it does also give him the sole burden of leadership. And let's not forget, although there isn't a time trial, of particular strategic importance, there is the cobbled stage, which does tilt things in Wiggins' favour. So you could come out of the first week with Wiggins ahead of Froome. I mean, it's going to be absolutely fascinating if it splits up. And let's remember as well, the cobbles this year are going to be harder than in 2010. There's some really hard sections, nine sections of cobbles. All of them have been in Paris-Roubaix. It was a bit cobbles light in 2010. And yet still Wiggins was right up there at the front, and I think he'll be right up there at the front. It's then all about where Chris Froome is in the mix. He could lose 2 minutes on that stage without any without anything going wrong.
I love the positioning of that climb up to La Planche des Belles Filles, which is a repetition of 2012, where of course Wiggins, that was where Wiggins ended up in the yellow jersey and Chris Froome took the stage win. It was a historic day. But to see those two riders in altered circumstances 2 years on going up the same climb at roughly the same point in the Tour is fascinating, isn't it?
Well, what happens if Wiggins is ahead of Froome overall at that point? I mean, it's you know, we couldn't have had a better time for Wiggins to come back to form. And I think we saw at the Tour of Britain last year just how good he is at picking an objective and building towards it and ticking it off. He did exactly the same in California last week, and his preparation for the Tour is you know, of an equal level to Chris Froome's, I think.
Have you seen him recently, Lionel? I mean, before California, I haven't seen him for months and months and months, so I don't know what he's like in terms of, you know, when you have contact with him.
I know he has a beard. For all that I said that Froome may overrule Wiggins' selection,
you've got high def.
What we have to bear in mind, of course, is that Dave Brailsford is the manager of the team, and it's incumbent on him to manage the team. And if Wiggins is, you know, one of the best riders, one of the strongest riders they have, and potentially one of the best allies to Froome in the Tour, then it's a case of, it doesn't, you know, what riders want shouldn't really come into it, should it?
Remember all the last minute team selection shenanigans ahead of 2012 involving Cavendish? You know, the Sky's strength isn't always getting these decisions right and timely. You know, there was a lot of last minute readjustment, and Cavendish wasn't always going to ride that Tour, far from it.
Well, no, and he certainly didn't get the team support that he wanted in that particular race, did he? It's going to be, you know, we've got 6 weeks now of constant kind of conjecture and speculation, and the next big battleground will be the Dauphiné, and I think that will tell us a little bit more about how Sky are doing. Ned is gesturing at a hat tip.
Adam Yates, I was going to say Adam Yates. Let's not forget Adam Yates. What a terrific first season he's having. Yeah. You know, and Simon Yates' brother. There's not much to choose between them in terms of talent. He's got a broken collarbone at the moment. It's quite mouth-watering to think what those guys might be capable of, because, yeah, he's riding exceptionally well. I thought he might have won a stage, actually, in California. Was it Mountain High, the stage that he attacked towards the end, and seemed to time it right? And on those sort of uphill finishes, we've had lots of great riders in Great Britain the last 10, 15 years, but we've not had many really talented sort of pure climbers, and these guys look, you know, with Simon Yates' victory last year at the Tour of Britain on a summit finish, these guys look like they could do the business on the climbs.
And not to take anything away from Chris Froome, but these two brothers are as British as black pudding. They're from Bury, you see, black pudding, home of black pudding.
They're a bit like the Brownlee brothers, aren't they? When you talk to them, there's not a great deal of, how can I put this politely, there's not a great deal of complication going on with their answers.
They're grounded
is the right word. Simon Yates, fascinatingly, wears cycling shoes that have laces. I don't know which manufacturer that is, but what's that all about?
The cycling shoes used to have laces, Ned. There was a time before 1985 or something, I think. Was it Bernardino wearing his Patrick shoes, blue Patrick shoes, in the 1985 Tour? Was that the first time we really saw Velcro? That's an interesting.
Could well be, yeah. That's a
topic.
Do write in at cycling_podcast.
I remember Stephen Roach in 1987 wearing his Vittorias with laces still. I thought they were cool shoes.
I've got one more Yates question. Mm-hmm. Is one or either of them, or even both of them, going to make the Tour de France team? I mean, they're very young, and it would be. But Orica don't have a GC rider, really, do they? They don't have someone. They haven't got anyone else like the Yates brothers.
You're suggesting Adam Yates could win the Tour?
No. But I'm suggesting.
You heard it here first.
No, he won't win the Tour. He won't come close to winning the Tour. But it'd be. I'd love to see him in the team.
I was joking. Yeah, I think. I mean, Orica, what a season they're having, and they're having an incredible Giro, as we'll talk about in the next section. But you're right. They don't have a sort of GC rider, do they? And they might just. Put one of them in for experience, who knows?
Well, in 2007, when the Tour started in London, you know, Geraint Thomas was the youngest rider in the race riding for Barlow World, and arguably probably wouldn't have got selected had he not been British. Likewise, Charlie Wigelius was a lot older, obviously, but, you know, he was a shoo-in for the, I think, Liquigas team at the time. You could imagine, perhaps not Simon, because obviously he's recently crashed, he'll be recovering from his injuries, but yeah, I mean, you could imagine Orica is going to get them a lot of publicity, isn't it, if there's a British rider in their team.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So as Lionel's head frazzles under the blazing sun here in the courtyard of the British Library, it's turning a nice shade of pink, lobster pink, as we speak.
Giro d'Italia, Maglia Rosa pink.
Yeah. we'll try and stretch this out as long as possible.
What a seamless link, though, Richard, eh?
Giro. We were obviously at the start in Belfast and Dublin and had a great time there, and then the race carried on without us in Italy, controversially. And it's been a pretty entertaining first week. Cadel Evans has, well, there's a point of discussion. Cadel Evans is in the pink jersey as we speak, and he's ridden a pretty flawless race so far, has got a very strong team. Nairo Quintana has been a couple summit finishes so far. Maybe expect to see a little bit more of him. Domenico Pozzovivo has emerged, perhaps as the rider who is certainly really taking the race by the scruff of the neck, and he's up to, I think, fourth overall at the moment. So he's a threat with his time trialing ability as well. What have you made of the Giro so far, Ned?
Well, yesterday, well, I shouldn't time reference this, the stage before the rest day, so that's summit
Sunday.
Finish. Yeah. That Pozzovivo made his attack was interesting, but only because of Pozzovivo's attack. The GC riders marked each other again for the main favourites for a second successive day, so I don't think that race has started yet. It will at some point, I guess. You're right to say that they should have one eye on Pozzovivo, because he finished third behind in the time trial of the Vuelta?
Yeah.
Behind
Vuelta.
Martin and Cancellara?
Yeah.
So, you know, he can do some damage there, because the rest of them won't perform in that discipline to that degree. Uran still looks like probably the most natural favourite in the race, but I've not been entranced by it yet. I think it's a damn shame Marcel Kittel's gone home, because the sprinters field looks like a bunch of second string sprinters now, and it's a real shame that Dan Martin crashed as well early on. I was on a different race, which we're going to come to in the next part of the podcast, and I was working alongside Neil Martin, his dad, who drives the doctor's car on British domestic races, and I spoke to him the following morning about his son, and he said that Dan was absolutely devastated to have, like, the Giro has been absolutely his focus now for a year. This particular Giro, been building up to it, thought the course suited him. And now he kind of feels he'll be put under pressure by his team to ride the Tour, which is something he doesn't want to do. So he would prefer to do the Vuelta, I think, but he might be forced into riding the Tour, which would be great for us on ITV and great for the British viewing public and all that. But shame that his real target is gone. So I've not been bowled over by the Giro so far. It's not quite had the fireworks of recent years as early on.
Good to see an Italian rider. You know, we talk a lot on our podcast about the sort of dearth of quality Italian riders. Diego Lisi has won two stages. He's having a great season, won a stage at Tour Down Under as well, and, you know, a good finisher, and it's always good to see an Italian winning at the Giro, and a young Italian emerging as he has done in a sort of revitalised Lampre team.
Yeah, I mean, interesting what you say, Ned. I mean, there has been a lot of the Giro that has been a tricky watch if you're trying to sell a sport to the public, and saying, you know, I always sort of tiptoe this, you know, do you tell people to sit and watch 3 hours of some of these stages? Because I think if you do, you're setting them up for a fairly uneventful afternoon. And unfortunately, I mean, the most interesting stages probably until the weekend was I think Thursday, where there was the big crash just coming out of the roundabout, and Giampaolo Caruso was the most seriously injured, and for a little while he was just motionless on the ground, and it was one of those horrible moments where you wanted the camera to sort of cut away, but also you wanted the camera to stay on him so you could see him move, because for a little while it looked like it could have been extremely nasty. That fortunately, you know, he was fine. He was taken off in the ambulance, and, you know, he's going to be okay. But in terms of the actual racing, the two most interesting stages were the two weekend stages in the medium mountains. On Saturday, Julian Arredondo of the Trek team was kind of the most aggressive rider of an early 10-man break, and for a long time it looked like he was going to stay clear. And then Europcar, they played their team tactics very well. They had an advanced rider, Kemener, who kind of set off initially marking the first attack, and then Pierre Hollande came from behind and then joined up with Arredondo, and then the two of them were, you know, in the last 3 kilometres, it looked like Roland was going to rob Arredondo of a deserved victory, and then Roland got robbed of a deserved victory himself, and it was a victory for kind of conservative tactics. So Ulisi came out of the sprung out of the main group, and in fact, you know, even Danny Moreno, who looked like he might have it, he faded very quickly, and it was just an indication that aggression and kind of, you can put all the planning and all the work into a 5-hour stage like that, but really it's just sitting tight, staying in the wheels and choosing your moment absolutely perfectly, which is what Ulisi did. And in a way that should be applauded and praised, but it was a shame that the kind of
it didn't get rewarded. Liège Bastogne-Liège, what we were saying about Liège Bastogne-Liège and Simon Gerensman. Yeah, I mean, you can be critical, but then Ulisi, as Gerens did, judged it perfectly and got his tactics spot on. It was a far trickier finish than I think a lot of people expected. That final kilometre took forever. I watched the stage knowing the result, knowing that Ulisi had won it, and I watched them in the final kilometre, in the final 800, 600 metres, thinking, they must have got the results wrong. How's Ulisi going to win this? You know, it was on a plate for Roland, it looked like, and he looked like he got it right. Great to see him attacking, great work by Europcar as well there. With Cadel Evans in pink now, I think there's a lot of very good climbers in the race, you know, Quintana, Uran, Pozzovivo, Arredondo. There's all these talented climbers, and so that you hope that they will take the race to Evans. They have to, don't they?
Well, they will do, and I think the course is so backloaded with the tough mountain stages in the last week. That was why it was interesting on Sunday's stage to see Pozzovivo put so much work in to gain really only a couple of handfuls of seconds. Yes, he's moved up the classification, but he's worked very hard for minimal gain, and I think he probably would have been smarter to do what Quintana and to an extent Uran are doing, and saving themselves for the last week.
It is quite difficult, isn't it, it's something that Christian Prudhomme has got very right over the last few years. When you're designing a three-week stage race, and backloading is great in principle, and that's obviously the way that this Giro is going to pan out, but in terms of kind of marketing your event, it hasn't caught fire yet for good reasons. The GC guys are sitting tight for the time being, and there is a danger that the race can just kind of slowly drift away from public gaze, because it ain't been that interesting over the first week. So it's a tricky balance, isn't it? And I think Prudhomme's model of throwing in a few, you know, slightly more unpredictable stages early on works slightly better.
I think, you know, they've attempted that, haven't they, with these two stages just at the weekend gone. And to be fair, if we were to look at Sunday's stage and the brilliant finish between Peter Wiening and David Malacarne, where, you know, they it was like a track sprint at the end where they both came to a standstill. They were trying to manoeuvre one another into the right position. And I wouldn't have bet my house on it, but I was convinced Malacarne was going to win that.
Were you?
I was, yeah, because in those two, in that sprint, I would always take the stockier, more powerful guy than the kind of tall, skinny spaghetti armed climber.
But he just—I don't know—he just looked stronger, didn't he? I thought. I mean, I don't know.
And he rides for Orica Green Edge, and they win everything at the moment. Again, though, it reminds me a bit of Matteo Trentin's victory last year in the Tour de France. When your team is on a roll, you've got nothing to lose. You know, the team's Giro does not hinge on. And in that kind of situation, especially when it slows down like that, nerves play a big part. You know,
helicopter overhead. Yeah, I think the race is coming.
Yeah. We can pretend we're at the Tour.
Yeah, I think that I can see the helicopter in the valley there. Nerves play a big part, especially when it does become quite tactical like that. And the rider who has least to lose often wins. And I think for Peter Wiening, there was nothing to lose. His team was already has already had a great Giro. And so I think that was possibly, well, not the decisive factor, but certainly a factor in him winning.
So we're looking ahead, though, at the end of the race. We are still waiting for this head-to-head between, I still think, Uran and Quintana, the two Colombians. What do you think, Ned?
It has to be those two, really, doesn't it? I mean, Pozzovivo is the great, you know, what he demonstrated. It would be brilliant if he can repeat that and sustain it and build into it, because they're very different riders, though, Uran and Quintana, aren't they? So whether one will come to whether they'll match each other on any given climb is not, you know, there might be climbs that suit Uran better than Quintana, so they might come to prominence at different points as the mountains loom large.
That would be perfect, wouldn't it, if we saw this kind of ebb and flow. That was what I was talking about in our kind of Giro preview in the last podcast, that we really want to see the clash of styles. The fact they're from the same country adds a different dimension to it, and an added dimension. But yeah, you're absolutely right. We could see Quintana go on the real steep sections and Uran kind of reeling back time on the more power climbs and in the time trials as well.
I mean, the interesting thing is we've not seen, there have been a couple of summit finishes and they've been conspicuous by their absence. They haven't tried anything, and that could just be because they're keeping their powder dry. I did read a little report that Quintana is suffering from a niggling buttock injury, is having some pain there, and he hasn't. You would have expected to see them try something, I think, but it is a long race, and they're perhaps, you know, looking towards that third week, as Quintana did last year at the Tour, and as Uran did. Both of them sort of emerged in that final week into second overall at the Giro and second at the Tour. So, you know, perhaps they're just following that same strategy, and their sort of lack of aggression at this point will end up paying off.
Are we writing off Cadel Evans then, Ned?
Well, the very fact that he's doing what he's doing, I think, is absolutely breathtaking. I remember watching him just over a year ago in one of his first appearances of the season at the Criterium International, and he wasn't finishing 2 or 3 minutes off Port and Froome up that final climb to the Ospedale. He was 13 minutes down or something extraordinary. He was absolutely, and in my mind there was no disputing the fact that TJ Van Garderen at that point a year ago had taken over a preeminent position within that team, and yet there, you know, back comes Evans, and he came back at the Tour, he came back, and he's come back again now. How he's wringing out all this ability out of the dying embers of his career is absolutely amazing, and it speaks volumes about his character, doesn't it, about his mental strength.
Yeah, he's what is he now, 48?
Yeah,
52?
I mean, he's 36.
He was born about 36, wasn't he? Imagine pictures of Cadell as a newborn would be absolutely fascinating, wouldn't they? That furrowed brow.
Is it harsh to say that his voice sounds a lot younger than he looks?
Yeah,
that is a bit harsh. Yeah, we know what's going to happen, don't we? He's going to be grinding up these steeper climbs while these little Colombians and Pots of Evo attack him left, right and centre. You know, be a bit like 2011 at the Tour when he was up against the Schlecks. And he was able to grind it out. I'm not sure that he will be able to grind it out here, although he does have a strong team around him. Mm. Probably a stronger team here than he had then. So still everything to play for. As I said at the start, he's ridden a flawless first week. He's always near the front. You know, those three guys and Pots of Evo, they've all avoided all these crashes as well, haven't they? And that can, you know, it's taken Rodriguez out of the race. And, you know, again, not to underestimate the effects of crashes on recovery, on sleeping and so on. And avoiding those first week crashes is, I think, extremely important in a 3 week tour.
The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
So we're going to turn our attention finally to the women's tour. We've mentioned it in our podcast, but we weren't able to really go into too much detail because we weren't there, unfortunately. The Giro took us over to Belfast, and very unfortunate timing that the first ever women's tour of Britain clashed with the Giro coming to Ireland, and other work commitments took us to Ireland. But Ned, you were there, and I think, judging from what I've read, from what I saw of the race, it was a huge success. Great crowds, good racing, a very worthy winner. What were your impressions?
It ticked almost every box that, you know, the organisers and the broadcasters, the riders and the local authorities, who, let's face it, put up most of the money, could possibly have wished. I mean, the weather wasn't great, but that didn't stop people turning out in huge numbers. And this race is the fortunate heir to, I think you have to say, 10 years of hard graft and hard work by Sweet Spot, who've been rewarded with the new, you know, the renewed contract for the people who organised the Tour of Britain, whose idea it was to get to breathe new life after the absence of, you know, after the Prue disappeared into this event. And they've stuck at the men's race now and augmented that with the Tour Series. You know, think of that what you will, but they've definitely created a scene where there was none. And now to have the bravery, I think, to summon into life for the first time in our history a women's stage race, and there really aren't very many stage races for women in the calendar, and just stick it in the diary and get the funding off the ground, get television to commit to nightly hour-long highlights free to air, which is, I'll come to that, the importance of that in a minute, but that's fundamental to how this works. And then for it to be attended and ridden in quite the way that it was is a real triumph. And I think just reward for them for, you know, putting up with some pretty hairy moments of keeping the men's race alive, which is now firmly established and growing year on year, it seems. So I think the women have benefited from all of that. And And a race isn't a race, and a spectacle isn't a spectacle without a crowd. And the crowds were bafflingly immense. I mean,
what drew the crowd, do you think? Was it? I mean, the British Olympians, Laura Trott, Lizzie Armitstead, yeah. People like that. Were they a bit like the men's tour, but in the crowds, a lot of them do come out to see Bradley Wiggins or Mark Cavendish, rather than a bike race. Was that the case here, do you think?
There are for a sport which doesn't really exist on the television at all. You know, aside from the 4-yearly cycle of the women's Olympic road race, there are a surprising number of women riders who are probably, you would have to say, household names. Laura Trott's in that category. Emma Pooley probably isn't, but she's a name to a lot of sports fans. She rode it. Lizzie Armitstead is all over BP garages up and down the country. And I think, looking further afield, I think that there are a large number of people who know the name of Marianne Vos, even though they don't necessarily know who she is and why she's so great. So there's a surprising level of, I hesitate to use the word knowledge, but awareness, at least, about some of the characters in women's cycling, which actually defies logic, because there isn't very much coverage. So it was good that the organisers managed to assemble all the key names. The only significant women rider who wasn't there was Kirsten Wild. Giant Shimano, who have a very, very strong women's team. They've just won a race in China, and Kirsten won the overall. They really dropped a ball there. They should have been at the race. They acknowledge now they underestimated quite what a impact it would have, and they will certainly be there next year with their strongest team. So you can therefore say, if you want to watch a stage of next year's women's tour, it will be like watching a shortened women's Olympic road race, and then there's another one the following day and another one the following day. You know, that's how you kind of got to bill it. And it delivered on that, because the other big fear, I think, that if they're honest with themselves, they probably wouldn't sit here and say this, but I'll say it on their behalf, that the organisers had, was that the strength and depth of women's cycling would not produce a compelling racing spectacle, that that it would rip apart very quickly. And, you know, halfway through stage one, a group of favourites would have got away that probably wasn't much more than 5 or 6 strong, and then Marianne Vos would attack them, and the race would be over by the time you'd reached Northampton or wherever it was we finished on the first day. And that didn't happen. In fact, the choreography of the way that the lead changed hands was perfect, because it wasn't until stage 3 or 4 that Vos started winning. Then she got herself into the leader's jersey, and then she extended her lead. You know, the only frustration in terms of the narrative of the race from a British perspective is that Lizzie Armitstead turned up with her wrong head on. She wasn't particularly happy. She didn't particularly enjoy the race, I don't think. She wasn't, for whatever reason, she wasn't in peak form. She found the competition a little bit too hot for her. She had a lot of bad luck as well, puncturing in the final, I think twice, or having a mechanical once and puncturing another time, and then just not quite reading the sprints properly, because pretty much every day it ended in either a group or a bunch sprint.
Why was that? Did you speak to her? Did you get a sense of why that was? Was it just frustration at her own form? Or?
Yeah, Lizzie can be... She's a good ambassador for the sport, but like all kind of alpha female... if that's a term, I've just made it up, but like all alpha female athletes, you know, she doesn't take to losing very well.
She has a bit of Cavendish about her, doesn't
she's
she?
She's got a lot of the Cavs about her, and she grew increasingly unhappy with the combination of her own lack of form, I think, and the considerable bad luck she had, and she didn't turn up on the final day, she climbed off. So Armitstead aside, and Laura Trott took a hell of a fall as well. She didn't figure. I mean, it's just not something that suits her, these kind of stage races. So she didn't figure in any of the finals, but she made it all the way around despite taking a really heavy fall on the penultimate stage, which is great for the crowds, because the enthusiasm.
Well, great for the crowds that she fell off.
No. Sorry, that came out all wrong, didn't it? But to have her all the way around to the end, you know, she's you shouldn't underestimate how popular that woman is in this country. Yeah. So there were all sorts of nice stories, and you know, on the day after she took her fall, the next day's stage started in Cheshunt, which is the Trott's home. Do you live out that way, Lionel?
Yeah, no, I live not far from Welling, so and she obviously rode on the track at Welling, the outdoor track there a lot. So that was her That was her home turf. A few people around where I live complaining they couldn't get to John Lewis on the Saturday afternoon, but, you know, that's to be expected, isn't it?
How very Hertfordshire.
It's nice that the Women's Tour paid that tribute to you, the Lionel Burney stage of the Tour Women's Tour.
Well, actually, the Tour of Britain's coming to Hemel Hempstead in September, which is where I went to school. So, you know, I think that's a true tribute. This was just a warm-up.
Hat tips all round.
It's Matt Stevens' old patch as well, though, Hemel Hempstead, isn't it?
I'm sure that has nothing to do with it.
But on that day, that she, before the stage got underway, she opened. She's only, 21, Laura Trott, still, unbelievably. She opened a really nice new leisure centre in Chesham that bears her name, the Laura Trott Leisure Centre. you know, which isn't bad if you're 21. And it was quite a day, actually, because when they all crossed the line in Welling, Welling Garden City, later on that day, in a little group of four or five off the back, detached by about 30 seconds, her sister, her older sister, Emma, crossed in floods of tears and was patted on the back by Emma Pooley, who happened to be in that same group, and then went to the press and announced that the following day would be her last ever race, and she would retire immediately. So it was kind of a big deal for the Trott family that day, and I think that the cycling public enjoyed that story, you know, with its kind of highs and lows. And it was really good. It'd be interesting to see how they grow it as an event. They took the right decision to hold it on pretty flat terrain and not have anything, you know, they didn't have a time trial, they didn't have anything that remotely looked like a mountain. You know, I think it'll be a few years yet before that kind of thing comes into play, but it's a hell of a good start.
Don't you think it's a danger to try and just replicate a men's race for women? I think that's the wrong route to go down. Make the race compelling for the sake of the women that are competing. And you know, the history of men's cycling has been, you know, courses have been tailored or influenced by the types of riders that have been dominant at the time. So I mean, to have a race, it adds prestige. When you look back in 10 years at the first women's tour and see that Marianne Vos won it and won three stages, that automatically gives it a kind of a credibility and credence right from the off, doesn't it?
I think you're absolutely right, and I hadn't, because it's not available really to watch, I hadn't, you know, this is my first real kind of immersion in watching the way women's racing, how it looks, the grammar, if you like, of how a stage unfolds, and it is markedly different, or at least in this stage of its evolution it is. I mean, who knows what it might look like in 20 years, but there is a certain, there's a kind of different, there's a slightly changed feel to it, isn't there? And when attacks go, they kind of, there's not that same explosivity. So there's nonetheless very fascinating how an attack can kind of stretch rather than break, you know. So you have to kind of read it slightly differently. You know, I don't know if this stands comparison, but there was a time a few years ago in tennis, not a sport I understand or watch a great deal of, that when Sampras was winning everything, and a lot of tennis, men's tennis, had been reduced to Goran Ivanisevic and Sampras serve and volley, and points lasted, you know, 10 seconds, and then they were done. Where a lot of people said, if you like tennis and appreciate the game, watch the women's game, because that's where tennis is being played. And I wonder if that, there's something in that with women's and men's cycling or something, you know, you can use that kind of comparison. It's certainly, it is different, yeah.
Certainly in Marianne Vos, and I don't know how your dealings were with her, but she is a fantastic ambassador for women's cycling and for cycling in general. Not only is she a terrific all-rounder, you know, we talk about Jenny Longo and people like that, but perhaps Marianne Vos is the best women's cyclist of all time, certainly the most versatile. And that, as you mentioned, adds prestige to the race, doesn't it? And not only the fact that she won it, but her embrace of it. She seemed to really buy into it even before the race had started, and once it had started, she proved to be a great ambassador.
And she brought her cat. Is that true, or was that a joke? I mean, I saw this on Twitter, the pictures of a cat in a lead. Extraordinary. I mean,
her mum and dad go with her on every race. Right. They follow the team around in a camper van, and they look after a cat on a lead, which belongs to Marianne Vos. They're truly eccentric. Lovely. Henk and Connie Vos, you would never know was the mother of the greatest female cyclist that's ever lived. She's a chain-smoking, hard-living, wonderful woman. And yeah, they support her. There's no cycling pedigree in their family whatsoever. Henk played a bit of football, and Connie never did a thing apart from smoke, I think.
Didn't Marianne start cycling with her older brother and quickly became better than him, and that's how she was very competitive with him, and that spurred her on a bit.
Absolutely right. You know, she's a superstar, and the comparisons with Merckx are a little bit fatuous, because you're not really comparing like with like, are you? But there's something in it, because she can do it on all terrain. She's untouchable at the moment. No one's close to her, and she's very young still. What is she, 27, 28? So she's got a lot of years ahead of her. But she's a superstar that is not, and this is the interesting point, she's not used to superstar treatment. You know, she may have quite a lot of money shoveled away in the bank, but, you know, Geraint Thomas is probably wealthier than her, you know, I would imagine. And certainly she is not used to being mobbed wherever she goes. Now, for a week in East Anglia, she was mobbed. And I think it blew her away. You know, it took her a while to adjust to it. But to feel the levels of excitement and respect that encounter her on British roads was a real eye-opener, not just to her, but to Emma Johansson, to the other riders who put themselves through an awful lot of hard work and misery for scant reward, next to nothing in most cases, week in, week out, through the year. You know, this race is a proper reward for them, and I think, wonderful.
They did reportedly have problems, you know, getting a title sponsor and getting the sort of backing they needed for the race. I don't think they'll have problems in the future,
well,
will they?
Well, I was at the, football being my other kind of day job, I was at the FA Cup final recently, and I bumped into our head of sport, and his first words to me, you know, even though this is one of the biggest football days on the ITV calendar, where you could have forgiven him for being preoccupied, was he wanted to talk about the women's tour. He wanted to say it came over very well, and tell me how many people watched. Now, I probably shouldn't, because I'm not authorised to tell you how many people that was, but suffice it to say, it was kind of the same numbers of people who 3 or 4 years ago were watching the Tour de France coverage. So, you know, it's jumped in at a very high level.
What's interesting, the debate about women's cycling and where it stands in relation to the men, there's been a lot of argument in favour of the established men's races holding women's equivalents. And I was at Flesh Wallonne, and I've been at the Tour of Flanders in the past, and seen when the women's race is held on the same day as the men, and it's just totally sidelined, it's pushed to the side. I mean, at Flesh Wallonne, they finish on top of the hill, and it's very much, there's sort of 10 minutes, and then they're all, you know, everyone's got to get off the road. The women's event is very much a sort of sideshow. And I don't think it gives that branch of the sport the kind of respect. It's important to have, certainly, but it's not the pinnacle. And so to have a women's race where the focus is purely on that event for 5 days, you know, that has to be a huge step forward in terms of the development of the sport.
It's like a support act, isn't it? If you go and watch a band and there's a support act, no matter how good that support act is, they will never command the same level of interest and attention. And Marianne Vos can ride Tour of Flanders the morning of the men's Tour of Flanders and be more or less ignored in a part of the world where cycling is huge and where she will certainly be well known. But as soon as you sort of put them up alongside each other for comparison, the one that is less well recognised will just fall off the radar completely.
So do you think that La Course is a bad idea? La Course being the women's criterium race that will be held on the Champs-Élysées ahead of the men's race on the final day.
I don't think it's a bad idea, but I don't think it will have the same level of interest as an event as the Women's Tour of Britain, because as you say, the Women's Tour of Britain stands alone on its own 2 feet, and it will inevitably be a sideshow to the men's tour, which will be arriving in Paris having, you know, completed its 3-week journey around France. The people riding it will be well known, the stories will be well known, the yellow jersey will be fated on the Champs-Élysées, and they will be a sprite there. I don't know what the solution to that is, because it would be perhaps hard to hold it at another time and get that kind of interest. So maybe it's a compromise solution, but I don't think it will have the sense of prestige that the Women's Tour probably had.
Can I just congratulate you there for saying the Women's Tour, because they deliberately haven't called it the Women's Tour of Britain. It's the Women's Tour, and I think that speaks of their ambition to basically, as an ambulance goes past on Marylebone Road, that they want it to be the biggest race in the calendar.
Perhaps they can take it anywhere. Start it in Dubai.
Yeah. Sweet Spot would love to pay the travel expenses for that, wouldn't they?
Okay, so that's it for this week. Next week we'll be rejoined by our friend Daniel Freeb, who currently is in the Pyrenees in France with Francis Dejeux and Thibaut Pinot and friends as they recce some of the stages for the Tour de France. He's sure to come back with a few stories from there. He likes hanging out with young Frenchmen, doesn't he, Daniel? Big fan, as we all are at heart. But Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Ned, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure, thank you.
The Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.